WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And now, Weekend Update with anchorperson Dennis Miller.
Dennis Miller has anchored the Weekend Update segment of Saturday Night Live since 1985. He delivers his topical humor in the form of a newscast.
Thank you. Good evening. And what can I tell you? While Wall Street suffered a down week, condom stocks continued to rise. I often hear people nowadays whine about the fact they have to wear condoms when they make love. This seems to me to be a rather minor argument. I'll tell you how I approach it. I wear two in my everyday life. When I go to make love, I take one off. I feel like a wild man.
Dennis Miller worked as a stand-up comic before joining the cast of Saturday Night Live. He hasn't given that up. He just finished a run at the New York comedy club Caroline's, and later this week he'll record an HBO comedy special. I spoke with Miller earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. The first anchor of Weekend Update was Chevy Chase. I asked Miller what he wanted to do differently than his predecessors.
I thought it was important not to look like I was worried about what they had done. It seemed to me that the error in doing Update in that five-year interim where the public perceived it not to work was that they seemed to be worried about how Chevy did it. I thought Chevy did it wonderfully. I mean, he invented it, and I think he's brilliant. He's a great guy. I mean, all that stuff is there. It's just that never once since I've been there have I really thought of him while I was doing it. I think if you look the least bit intimidated at that desk, the audience smells that it's like blood in the water. And they don't want to watch you because it's pretty pivotal position in that show. It's sort of the thing at midnight that whips it into the second hour, and you have to sit there and at least look like you're confident about it.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned confidence because you just exude self-confidence on that feature, and I don't know whether that's something you're really striving for, whether that's part of the act or whether you're naturally that self-confident.
No, that is part of the act. I mean, I'm as alternatingly confident and unconfident as any human being in my real life. But when I get to the desk, I try to manufacture it. I think it's important you look in control there. It's like when you watch The Dating Game and some guy's giving bad answers and you have to turn away from the screen. That's what it always reminded me of. If you're going to sit there, you might as well sit there and presume that you belong sitting there.
You don't want to be an inept bachelor number one.
Yes. That always made me cringe. So I figure, well, at least I'm going to go out on my shield if I have to go out.
I think you've developed Weekend Update into less of a place to spoof what TV news is like and more of a place to do political humor.
Well, I think that, it is less of a parody because I'm not really doing a news guy character there. The me that sits there is pretty much the me that does my stand-up or the me that does Letterman or Carson. You know, I don't really have a character up there. I don't do an impression of a newscaster. I'm just doing me reading the news. So I think it has become a little less of a parody of a newscast. As far as the political stuff goes, it's funny. If you strung together all political jokes there, I think you'd get buried. It seems like you have to intertwine these Weekend Update archetypes. Like, did you notice that Al Haig looks like Josie and the Pussycats drummer? You know, that sort of stuff. You know, you have to put those odd little jokes in there to keep it going. Because, you know, you can do the best political... I've done some political jokes up there that I thought were pretty good, and nothing. You know, it's pretty amazing. So I think you have to make this nice mix of things that you know are flat out funny and things that are wise and witty about politics. It has to be some sort of mix of the two.
Do you want to give an example of something that you thought really worked well and you got no response?
Well, naturally it's tough to pull a joke from the last 3 years, but I know there's been a couple that, I've set up there, and, you know, I can't really give you a specific, but jokes you really put a lot of thought into, and, you know, the people just look at you and you think, I don't even know if they know what this story's about. I'm not saying the crowds are dumb. I'm just saying that if you get too involved in the minutiae of news, then they're not going to follow you. You know, they're not reading the paper like you are 5 or 6 hours a day. So you kind of can't go back that far into the pages and talk about an arms deal with Guatemala that went wrong, you know.
When Johnny Carson does a joke that bombs, he frequently makes jokes about the script writers. Now, you write all your own material. If one of your jokes bombs, what do you do to keep moving, to salvage it?
Well, you know, I write the great majority of it. I don't write all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody there contributes. There's some wonderful writers, and I wouldn't want to say that I wrote it all. Herb Sargent helps me a lot, too. He's been there since Chevy. If a joke bombs, I think all the audience demands off of you is that you acknowledge that it stunk. I don't think they want you to sit there and be presumptuous enough to act like it worked, because that kind of diffuses the whole mystique that you're aware of what's going on up there. I like to look very aware of what's going on at Update. I think a crowd almost finds it endearing if a joke goes up in smoke and you look at them and kind of give that nod, and it almost can be unspoken that you know that one didn't fly. They like that. But conversely, if I do that, I sometimes get nailed for laughing at things. Believe me, I've written enough jokes in my life that I don't sit there and laugh at my own cuteness. I kind of laugh at the ambiance in the room when a joke gets a big laugh. I think that's kind of a neat feeling. And if I want to celebrate that for a second, I'll also do that. So if a joke stinks, I acknowledge it. If a joke goes exceptionally well, I think it's okay to look at them and go, yeah, that was okay, wasn't it? And I think just that in-the-moment awareness the crowd sort of reacts to and seems to like.
How do you put the material together? Do you spend a good deal of the week reading newspapers and news magazines, things like that?
Yeah, I'm less anal retentive about it than I used to be. I used to sit there every day and digest the news and try to spit out a certain amount of jokes each night. And I found that was a little, that didn't feel right. It felt a little too binding. So what I do is I just read the papers and watch the news Monday through Friday. Friday, I sit down around 4 in the afternoon with a tape recorder, and I usually have this sort of comedic bulimic purge from 4 to 7 where I blurt out maybe 30 jokes onto the tape recorder. And I naturally think they're all brilliant and wonderful, and so I leave them on the tape recorder till Saturday morning when I listen to them and find out that usually 15 of them are absolute tripe. And I take the 15 that are left and have them typed up and put into the script, try those at dress rehearsal, usually burns 3 of them when you see they won't function on air, usually go onto the air with 10 to 12 jokes that are they have a reasonable chance to succeed.
Do you have to run all this by standards and practices?
Well, anything that goes on network television has to be run by standards and practices. That's just the nature of the beast, but I've found them to be remarkably accommodating over the years.
Well, since you are lampooning real people, what are some of the guidelines you have to keep in mind so that you don't get sued?
I think the major guideline is that in our society over the last 3 years, it's become somewhat of a red badge of courage to be lampooned on Weekend Update. And to remember, if you're not patently cruel, they're not going to sue you, because they, in their own way, find it to be an inverse stroke that they've been ripped on Saturday Night Live.
They're important enough to be cut up there.
Yeah. I don't think people mind it unless you go for their loved ones or their, their innermost problem, something that's cruel, and I'm not a cruel person, so I pull things that I think might be too cruel, and I've never had a problem with anybody wanting to sue. I've had a couple stories over the years where I guess I missed the point and made a bad call. I guess that's going to happen, though, and I've received enough letters, and, you know, I've been, people get angry, and that's going to happen. It's a pretty volatile forum up there. I guess you can't make mistakes, but as far as being sued, Jesus, I don't think anybody sits at home and goes, I'm going to get that guy. I think they think, oh, well, I'm on Weekend Update.
Comic Dennis Miller is my guest. He anchors the Saturday Night Live Weekend Update segment. You know, on last week's rerun, you had something about the Pope, and you said that during the Pope's tour through America that he stood over one of those heating vents, and you showed a photo of him. You want to describe the photo that you showed?
Well, it was a photo that had been cropped, the top of the Pope onto the bottom of Marilyn Monroe from that, I don't even know what the film was. I just, 7 year itch?
I think it's a 7 year itch.
Yeah.
But her dress is blowing
regardless,
up.
Regardless, her dress is blown up over the subway grating.
I've had a lot of cartoonists tell me that the Pope is one of the most taboo subjects to lampoon in a cartoon. Did you ever have any trouble with that?
Yeah, I received some nasty letters about the Pope joke. I don't know. I didn't think it was that heinous an offense. I naturally think the Pope's a nice man and certainly an author in his own right, so I guess he understands the writing process. And I don't know. I guess it's the way you look at it. I didn't view it as that much of an attack on him. It was just that cute a picture.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody ever wanted to sit down with me and talk substantively about my feelings towards the Pope, they would certainly all be pro. And a nice man, and I am Catholic, and I have all those good feelings for him. I just never got to the point where I felt you couldn't poke a little fun at him. He seems to me to be just, you know, a man, you know, albeit a man with a good gig.
I always get the impression that you improvise some of your material, or at least some of the material between the lines when you're doing Weekend Update.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a moment before you say an improvised line where you think to yourself, should I do this or not?
Well, yeah, there is, and sometimes you edit, but for the most part, I think if you get that instinct, it's best to go with it.
Is there ever a time you went with it and you regretted it?
No, I just don't think it's of that, you know, I don't think it's that critical thing, and you know, you go with it or you don't. I don't think you can regret it afterwards. I mean, it's... You really have to trust your instincts as a performer. I don't fancy myself as a great, great performer, but I think in the moment, I think pretty quick, and I usually trust what I say out loud. And I also know that I've set up a nice fail-safe system in my own head where anything that's that controversial or that on the edge won't get out, because I realize it is network television, and it doesn't pay to make such a radical point that you're going to end up getting burnt for it. So I've already set up a code in my head of certain things that won't get out, and they just don't.
Your hook is always I'm out of here. That's what you always say when it's over. How did you come up with that? It seems like it always helps people on Saturday Night Live to have a line that they're really associated with.
Well, you know, I'm not... that line is certainly... not caught on anything like John's That's the Ticket or Dana's Isn't That Special, so I don't think it's a catchphrase even. It's just a sign-off.
You're seldom in any sketches on Saturday Night Live. How come?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I'm a wonderful actor. I don't know if I am or aren't, to be frank, because I've never done that much of it. But the fact is we have brilliant people there, and... the secondary fact is, in most sketches, I'd say there are two male leads, three maximum, and if you get down to the fourth, it's maybe me. But if you think about those first three, just for the success of the show, I'm not naive enough to see that the best three actors we have are Hartman, Lovitz, and Carvey. I mean, they're absolutely brilliant. Phil Hartman is, you know, to me, stunning. Lovitz is, to me, probably the funniest comedy actor I've ever seen in my life. He makes me laugh just outrageously. And Dana's like our rock star, you know? I mean, this guy knows how to hit the big beats. He comes in and he's like a cleanup hitter. He knows how to drive in runs. If I get an occasional part, that's fine. If I don't, that's fine, too. I see the show getting more successful, and I'm happy with that.
We're going to take a short break, Dennis, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is comic Dennis Miller, who anchors the Weekend Update feature on Saturday Night Live. He also has an HBO comedy special coming up. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Miller is my guest. How did you first get on Saturday Night Live? Did you have to do a formal audition?
I took over the studio at gunpoint one night. No, yeah, it's a pretty arduous auditioning process. It's kind of nebulous. It's not really defined. The thing I remember about it, looking back now, excuse me, is that it's very self-reliant process. Lorne kind of puts you up in front of a room full of people the whole staff of the show, the writers, the production staff, and he just looks at you and says, you have 15 minutes, do what you want to do. And at the time, I thought, Jesus, what a free-form idea that is. No direction. No, here's what we'd like to see. Here's what we're looking for. Just go ahead. And I thought, my. And as I look back on it now, it becomes obvious to me that being in front of that many million people live each week dictates that you are able to think for yourself. And his way of seeing whether you can do that or not is to not give you too much direction in the audition process.
So what'd you do in that audition?
Well, I did stand up. I did my jokes. But more importantly, I tried to look like I was nonplussed.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes obvious to me that the thing that gets you that show is the ability to look at them right in the eye and not blink. And I didn't blink, but that's not to say I wasn't scared out of my mind, but I think there comes a point in your life, if you've looked into yourself enough, and I had spent much of the 20s trying to figure out what made me tick, that you see there comes a point where you simply have to throttle your self-destructive side in these auditions and do well, just because you should care enough about yourself to do well. So I remember going into that interview being very frightened and thinking, or, you know, the audition, thinking, oh, God, what if I don't get this? And all those incredibly seedy thoughts that you always think and you're about to blow it for yourself. And then I had this moment of calm right before I walked in where I took a few deep breaths and said, you know, you've worked very hard your whole life and you're a pretty good person. You deserve this. I don't want to sound too Pollyannish here, but I had a moment of lucid thought where I remember thinking, you have to go in there and just look completely unflappable and just be a monster. You know, you have to be very funny and let them know that you can do this and you don't have any doubts that you can do this. And I went in, and I think in addition to the jokes being reasonably funny, I just looked like I could do it. You know, I gave that impression that I wasn't going to clam up if it came to that.
Well, you make it sound as if there had been auditions in your past in which you did things that were self-destructive.
Well, I don't think, you know, it's not as dramatic as you walk out in a petulant snit, but I think we all, in subtle ways, can self-destruct when the chips are on the table. I mean, we all had those pivotal crossroad moments in our life where self-destruction can even seem like self-pity. You can, you know, you can disguise and think, well, I've never gotten anything, and I probably won't get this either, and the world really is shafting. You know, that self, to me, reads self-destructive in a way, because when you get away from it and have a clarity of thinking, you see that that crap shouldn't go in there with you. That's, you know, unimportant at that moment. All that's important is you do as best as you can and then let them make their decision. So, yeah, I've had that happen where I've gone into things and thought, oh, I can't do this, you know, and go, and it all comes out in the wash. They see that.
Your first year in 1985 ended up being one of the least successful years for Saturday Night Live. That was the year that Anthony Michael Hall. Do I have the name right?
I always called him Michael. I don't know what the order was.
Robert Downey, Denitra Vance, John Lovitz, you were all in that cast that year. And it was a year that was really torn apart in the press. I think the ratings probably went down.
Mm-hmm.
Did that blow your self-confidence for a while?
No, not in the least.
Did you have a lot of friends coming up to you, friends who meant well, critiquing what everybody should do on the show to make it better?
Uh-huh. Everybody does.
Did you want to kill them for that?
No. I remember when I was young, there was a comedian named Kelly Monteith who still works, and I saw him one night. I had yet to do comedy. I was like 18 years old, and he told me, there are going to be people coming up to you and telling you you're the best thing in the world. He said, you can't listen to them. There are people who are going to come up to you and tell you you're the worst thing in the world, and you can't listen to them. But you do have to listen to the voice inside your own head that, you know, your taste alarm, how are you doing? I gave an honest effort in that first year, and as much as the working press and much of the public might hate this statement, I don't mean to sound overbearing, smug, or self-serving. I happen to like what I did. I didn't love what I did, but I liked what I did, and I worked very hard at it, and I felt comfortable with it. Therefore, when I would read in the press how horrible I was, I would think, well, fine, that's man's opinion. There's two ways you can go in life. You can choose to do something, or you can choose to appraise what other people choose to do. I just chose to do something, and therefore you leave yourself wide open to being appraised by people who chosen to appraise as their means of doing. And if a critic hates me, that doesn't even anger me. I don't know if I can make that differentiation. I don't sit there and stew about it. It just doesn't mean that much to me. I hope it means a lot to him. It's his opinion, and he should certainly value it. But it's not my opinion. And if my opinion ever told me I was doing horrible work, believe me, I would do something to right it. But my opinion that first year told me I was making an honest effort, learning the ins and outs of network television, and at moments was quite funny. At other moments, I wasn't funny, but I expected that to happen, too. I was just starting out. So when I would read the critics, it didn't really tear me up. You know, it might anger them in some way for them to think that it doesn't tear you up, but the fact is, I had finally gotten a job I had strived to have for years.
Right.
And was quite happy there, and couldn't really take time out of my own life to sit and be depressed because of others' opinions. I was enjoying what I had.
You know, one of the things that you're doing now, you're doing stand-up. I don't know if you'd taken a break from doing the clubs or not, but I know last week you played at Caroline's in New York.
Mm-hmm.
This week you're filming an HBO comedy special and performance. Is it good for you to keep on doing stand-up even while you're doing Saturday Night Live?
Well, not only is it good, it merely is... It's what I'm about, you know. It's my raison d'être. I mean, it's what I do and what I'll always do. Stand-up is very important to me.
I've never seen you do stand-up. I've only seen you on the program. Can you give a sense of what kind of material you do in your club act?
Well, some of it's topical, so some of it's like the news, but it's more observations about life, things that interest me. Relationships, you know, and sex, and how the inadequacies of life and the incongruities, and you know, how cruel it can be one moment and how wonderful it can be the next. I guess that's the stuff of my humor.
Well, now I get to the really important question. You recently cut your hair after doing Saturday Night Live with very curly, wavy, shoulder-length hair. You recently cut it, and now it kind of rests securely behind your ears.
Yeah.
How come you got a cut? I always save that real heavy stuff for the end.
Yeah, you know, I've never even thought of it. I don't know why I grew it either, so I can't tell you that, but I don't know why I cut it either. Just, I got a haircut one day. But I'm amazed. You can't believe the mail you get. I mean, it's funny to me. It almost puts the whole television experience into perspective. I know sometimes these people who are given the keys to the hallowed kingdom believe that they're inside and it's some amazingly intricate, detailed, almost like a house of worship television is viewed as in this society. And the most letters I've ever gotten in my life is, why did you cut your hair? And if that doesn't put the whole thing in perspective, it's like you could write the best joke in the world. You could craft the most intricate, skillful, you know, wise joke, and I wouldn't get one letter about it. But I cut my hair, and you've got hundreds of little girls and women, you know, why did you cut your hair? Why did you? I like your hair now. I liked it, you know. To me, I remember reading these thinking, oh, well, I see what TV's about. It's about hair and eyebrows.
You said you could write the best joke and you wouldn't get any letters about it. But I'm sure you get a lot of letters about
yeah,
that
but
day.
Usually... Usually you get letters when people are angry.
Uh-huh.
Or you get letters about surface things. You don't get letters about, you know, specific jokes particularly. That just doesn't happen.
What do you think of as your greatest moment on TV?
Geez, I'm glad you qualified that, because my greatest moment certainly wasn't on TV. You know, I remember the first time I did a... I remember the first time I did David Letterman. I had never been on television before in my life. And I was very frightened. I mean, you're backstage and you're like in a rodeo shoot, you know, and they're about to open that gate and you're about to jump out. And you've got 5 minutes to really distill and translate to the American public everything you've worked with for 4 years, 5 years. You know, it's very important to a young comedian to make that first score. And I was standing back there and I was very frightened. And I walked out and I hit that mark and I looked at the camera. And my best moment on TV happened right then, and it was unarticulate, and nobody else knew about it. I took a deep breath and thought, oh, God, am I going to kill this? And I remember that moment, and to me, that's my biggest moment on TV, certainly a moment not shared with anybody because nobody else heard that. But in my head, all that work came together in one moment where I felt that I had prepared myself to the point that there was no way that this could not succeed and indeed kill. And that moment, you know, it was like a powerful, cathartic moment where you thought, oh, I see, all that preparation does mean something. It means you feel like you've got your valise packed, and there's nothing they can do to really derail you at this point. It's all in your court. It was an incredible feeling of power at that moment where you knew you were going to do well. Because up to then, it's kind of like, well, I do well tonight. But in that moment, I knew that I was about to kill it before
it even started. Did you?
Yeah.
How did it go over?
And it went really well.
Yeah, okay.
So that was my most important moment. It was just a moment in self-confidence. It taught me something about yourself, that it's all right to feel confident. You know, up to that point in my life, I had always thought it was becoming to be sheepish and shuffle your feet and think, oh, God, I hope I do. And in that moment, I learned that it's all right to go, hey, you're going to do well here.
Well, Dennis Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dennis Miller. You can see him on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. And he has an HBO comedy special, Mr. Miller Goes to Washington, which debuts on February 27th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.